Sir, I now call the council sixth witness, who is Mr. Keenan, an economist.
Thank you.
And his evidence is at volume 301, tabs 12 and 13.
Do you solemnly, sincerely and truthfully declare and affirm that the evidence you are about to give to this court shall be the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Good morning, Mr. Keenan. Is your full name Blair Desmond Keenan?
It is.
Did you prepare evidence in chief dated 26th of May 2023 and rebuttal evidence dated 25 August 2023?
Yes.
Do you have the qualifications and experience set out in paragraph 2 of your evidence in chief?
Yes.
Do you have any corrections to make to your evidence?
There is one correction to the to my rebuttal evidence in paragraph 18, on line 3. There's a reference to a Waipa catchment, which should be Waikato Waipa catchment.
Thank you. And did you attend expert conference on the 5th of September 2023 and sign the joint witness statement?
Yes.
And with the correction you've just taken us to, do you confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge?
Yes.
And just before we get into questions, when Dr. Scarsbrook was giving evidence, Commissioner Hodges asked him a series of questions about evaluating costs of fencing. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Now, going to paragraph 7 of your evidence in chief, you briefly summarise there the land allocation model and state that the model estimates the lowest cost set of mitigations. Just in general terms, are you able to assist us with the assumptions that the model makes about the level of fencing that would occur?
Yes, so this will partly be a question for Dr. Olabodi as well. So there's essentially the model specifies a certain amount of stream or river length in the catchment, and there's an estimate of how much of that's fenced already. So that forms the baseline. And then it's essentially says the remainder of that fencing is an option for further reducing contaminants into the waterways.
And you're able to comment on the relationship between the extent of water bodies and the extent of fencing that might be assumed by the model?
I think the discussion in the last few days around ephemeral and intermittent streams has raised some questions around how much of those are characterised in the model. And to the extent that they're not, then the potential is that there is more fencing that would be required. And that includes also for wetlands that weren't previously identified that would need to be fenced.
And would you say the relationship between fencing and water bodies is fencing required and extended water bodies is linear, or would you describe it in another way?
I don't think it would be linear. So it depends on the size of buffers, the shape of the flow paths, and those sorts of things, and through the terrain that it's flowing through as well, depending on whether it was flat, rolling, or steep.
Okay. And in terms of the extent of the wetlands, in particular, Commissioner Hodges was interested in the wetlands going down to 50 metres squared. Are you able to assist with any sort of indication of potential costs if for the moment, I guess the moment we do assume a linear relationship, although that is not the case with the model and how the model approaches it.
So I did do some informal calculations around what a 50 square metre wetland might involve in terms of fencing, assuming that there was no fencing there already. And based on a few assumptions around its form, so for ease of calculation, I assumed it was round, for example, and that there was a 3 metre buffer, and that would imply fencing costs ranging from $220 to $565 for that wetland. There's also a cost of what I've described as an opportunity cost of lost pastoral production. So on that basis, for a 50 square metre wetland, the costs on, say, dairy country would be $45 per year based on the calculations that use a production value the same as what I've used in my rebuttal evidence. Or for dry stock, $7.70. Now, because those are annual costs, I think it's appropriate to look at a net present value of all of the future revenue from that as well. So that would imply opportunity costs of $900 for dairy or $154 for sheep and beef. So adding the fencing and opportunity costs together would imply a 50 square metre wetland on a dairy farm would cost $1,290 and on a dry stock farm $660. If we were to think about the evidence that we heard earlier in the week where there are tens of thousands of these potentially, so grossing those up, essentially multiplying them by 10,000, implies $12.9 million if there were 10,000 of these on dairy farming, or $6.6 million if they were on dry stock. And there's a lot of assumptions in those calculations, obviously, but that's just to try and give some sense of scale.
Thank you. Please stay seated and answer your questions.
Good morning.
Thank you, Your Honour. Good morning, Mr. Keenan. I just want to take you to the witness statement for water quality. It's in 401 tab 1, volume 401. So just there, if you could go to question 38 in the witness statement. Just wanting there, it confirms that stock excursions and setbacks for pastoral grazing, cultivation, tracks, races, etc. from water bodies will reduce inputs of the four contaminants. With water bodies, you accept that?
Yep.
And then again, in the joint witness statement for lakes, that's in tab 2 of the 401 folder. If you could go to question 8 for me, please. And that deals with would it be beneficial to set targets for individual lakes and manage on a lake and individual catchment basis. But in the agreements reached, you note there that some management techniques, such as farm management plans, stock exclusion, and setbacks are acceptable or accepted as a universal best practice and applicable to all lakes. You accept that?
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Yes.
And if we could just go to the post-conference PC1 version, I should have configured a copy there. And if we could go to page 40 to Schedule C. And so at clause 2, if you bear with me, if you could just read to the court that first part of clause 2, don't need to go into A, B, C or D, just the first part please.
New temporary, permanent or virtual fences installed after this chapter becomes operative must be located to ensure farmed cattle, horses, deer and pigs will be excluded from the bed of the water body.
And so I guess the point there is that this provision only kicks in once the plan becomes operative. Yes?
If you say so, I...
You just read it?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm not a planner.
Right. I don't think you need to be a planner to read that bit of wording, yes? And so I guess the point I'm trying to make there is that the requirement to fence only kicks in after the plan is operative, so there's no requirement prior to the plan being operative to fence. Would you accept that?
Yes.
And so if you could go up to clause 1, and again please bear with me, if you could read out the first part of clause 1, you don't need to go into A or B.
The water bodies on the following land must be fenced with a temporary, permanent or virtual fence to exclude farmed cattle, horses, deer and pigs, unless those animals are prevented from entering the bed of the water body by a stock-proof natural or constructive barrier formed by topography or vegetation.
That's right. So with reading it together with clause 2, there's no requirement until this plan change becomes operative to fence, yes? And then in clause 1, there's like an exception there, isn't there, for fencing? The exception being unless those animals are prevented from entering the bed of the water body by a stock-proof natural or constructed barrier formed by topography or vegetation. So you accept there's an exception to fencing if that exception applies. And so would you therefore accept the proposition that Schedule C seeks to exclude stock from water bodies in accordance with best practice?
Yes.
And so you'd also accept that there's no requirement under Schedule C, at least, to remove or move existing fencing?
Yes.
If I could take you to your rebuttal evidence, please. That is in Volume 301 and tab 13. Oh, you have Amazon. So if you could go to paragraph 10 of your rebuttal. So you've accepted that there's no requirement to move existing fencing or fences. But in your paragraph 10, in the last sentence, you talk about while the difference in total amounts of fencing required may be ambiguous, there are likely to be changes to farm management regimes that are required, such as the need to move in existing fences. Is that still your evidence, Mr. Kingman?
I think that it's not always the case that you would need to move fences, but it may be the case in some circumstances.
And so just looking at exact sentence I've read out, you talk about changes to farm management regimes. Do you know of any examples of where farmers have already fenced water bodies and are undergoing farm management changes?
I can't speak to particular examples now.
Do you have any idea of the related change or cost to those farm management regimes that you referred to in your paragraph 10?
No, and I think that's why in the joint witness conferencing it was agreed that we weren't able to quantify.
That's right, yes. So that's in question 3 of the economics joint witness statement. I'll just read that agreement. And while we have some costs for some of the components, referring to question 1, which refers to various costs, due to the uncertainty with how much each farm will be affected, total aggregate costs for PC1 area cannot be easily calculated. To make such a calculation would be extremely large modelling exercise, and the result would be highly uncertain. That's the agreement reached, isn't it?
Yes.
So, in your, again, looking at paragraph 10, you indicate there that Mr. Council, the Director General's economist, has assumed the opportunity cost of lost commercial land is the only cost that would be associated with additional setbacks. That's your evidence, isn't it?
Yes.
If I could take you to Mr. Council's evidence,
I have a copy here, actually.
Oh, you do? Thank you. For the court, that's
volume 320, tab 3.
Thank you, sir. And at paragraphs 33 to 36 of Mr. Council's evidence, he states there in the second sentence of paragraph 33, the installation of fencing is a cost to farmers. However, I have not quantified the cost for two reasons. First, because in many cases fencing is not an additional cost of the Director General setback proposal relative to the PC1 setback proposal. And then further down in that same paragraph, in the last sentence, he says, nonetheless, and the second reason why I have not quantified fencing costs, there are material uncertainties regarding the fencing requirements, including the extent to which fencing already exists, the type of fencing installed, whether that's temporary, permanent or virtual, the features of the fencing, and whether the land exceeds the slope threshold that does not require fencing. So your statement at the beginning of paragraph 10 isn't quite right. He's actually identified reasons for why he hasn't made he hasn't only just assumed the opportunity cost of lost commercial land, he's actually explained in his evidence why he hasn't gone to any other detail. Do you accept that?
Yes.
So, would you want to rethink your statement in paragraph 10?
I think there are still reasons why you might have to move fences. For example, if you have paddocks that lose 10 metres off one edge, if you like, then you may have to reconfigure other parts of your farm as well, so that that paddock remains as a sort of an optimal size for your management practices.
Pause you there. I'm referring to your statement in your first sentence of paragraph 10, where you assume that the opportunity cost of lost commercial land is the only cost that would be associated with additional setbacks. You assume that that's all that Mr. Council has taken into account, but you haven't seemed to have factored in the reasons for that.
I accept that he has considered those other costs.
Thank you, Mr. Keenan. So I just want to talk a bit about the offsetting of additional costs. And if you could go to the economics JWS. It's 401 to tab 6. And so at question 2, well, I think it talks about, are there any factors that offset the additional cost? And then it goes and lists a few there in the matters of agreement. It's around floods, damage risk, stockhouse benefits, prevention of livestock drowning, and reduction of soil loss. So, just considering a 10-metre setback versus a 3-metre setback, with a 10-metre setback, the risk of flood damage is lower, you'd expect that, because the setback is wider.
So the conversation in the joint witness conferencing canvassed the fact that that vegetation in a wider riparian strip may not necessarily improve or reduce the flood risk in terms of damage to the farm.
Sorry, Mr. Keenan, there's nothing on the joint witness statement along those lines, is there?
No.
So would you accept then that just on the surface, a wider setback would provide better protection to the water body?
Yes, that seems reasonable.
Thank you. And when you're looking at the ephemeral fencing of ephemeral water bodies with a 10-metre setback compared to not fencing, which is what has been proposed, what are the benefits in terms of... I'll just back that question up. So under the PC1, there's no requirement to fence ephemeral water bodies. But you would agree that given that ephemeral water bodies carry the highest concentration of contaminants, they're at the headwaters normally, feed into the network of our catchment, it would be beneficial, wouldn't it, to water quality to fence ephemeral water bodies. Would you accept that?
That makes sense.
And so that, as a result, would improve water quality. That's another benefit.
That was my interpretation of your previous question, but yes.
Thank you. And the benefits in terms of preventing stock from drowning with setbacks, with the fencing, you'll have lower farm costs in terms of stock loss. So you'll have fences there.
As opposed to having no fence?
Yes. And the ecological evidence confirms wider setbacks, like the ones that the Director General proposes, leads to improved water quality, which you've accepted that. And so that would improve stock health. Would you accept that?
Other things being equal, yes.
And so that would reduce the cost, you know, if stock is healthier, reduce the cost of calling in vets, for example. That's another offset. You'd accept that?
Yep.
And so ultimately, with the proposed setbacks, it's better water quality in the wider catchment.
Yes.
And of course, in the hill country where the most concentrated contaminants are, those effects, it has to be a better than what's currently there. You'd accept that? Thank you, Mr. Keenan. Thank you, sir.
Waikato River Authority, Mr. Ryan, are you on the line?
Ms. Bielo, thank you, sir, and no questions for this witness for the River Authority.
Thank you, Ms. Bielo.
Thank you, just a couple of questions. Good morning, Mr. Keenan. In terms of the use of the model and the analysis that you've undertaken, that's relevant as far as looking at the appropriateness of the suite of provisions and the cost and benefits of those, aren't they?
So the modelling, which was originally done by the technical leaders group for Plan Change 1, was an exercise in assessing cost effectiveness. So essentially it takes the benefit side as given. That's the objective that you're trying to achieve. And then the model tries to determine what the best way of achieving that is.
Thank you. And so the technical leaders group undertook modelling what you refer to in your evidence as the baseline version. And then following the decisions version, there was some further work done to update the model to reflect the council decisions version. Is that correct?
Yes. So Dr. Oliver, you took that work?
Yes. But there hasn't been a subsequent exercise undertaken in terms of changes made since the decisions version, have there?
No.
So, for example, the softening of some of the stock exclusion provisions, those haven't been factored into the modelling.
They haven't been modelled.
Thank you. And open the questions.
Thank you. Then call for Lockie or Federated Farmers, Mr. Matheson.
Thank you, sir. I wasn't going to have any questions, but I just want to ask you some questions about the 50 square metre wetland issue. Were you asked to model that before last night or yesterday?
No.
You gave a figure of $220 and $665, and sorry, you're going a bit quick for me. Can you just remind me how that was made up, please?
For dairy or dry stuff?
We'll start at the chair.
Okay, so the fencing costs which I've used range from $220 up to $565.
Yep, so we'll just pause there. So what type of fence?
So those were numbers based on those from Mr. McGibbon's evidence.
Right, the updated numbers.
Yes, yep. I think it's from his. So that was a range from up to $12.85 per
metre. So the highest was $12.85?
Yes.
And was that for a post and batten fence, or was that done?
It's not specified.
Okay, so the highest figure you used was $12.
$12.85.
Right, so if the actual figure was closer to $20, then the cost would be a lot more.
That's right.
You used a 3 metre setback, and I can't remember my trigonometry. So what length does that give you around a circle?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
44 metres. 44 metres. And then with a 10 metre setback, it would obviously be significantly more.
88 metres.
Yeah. So double. More than double. Yeah. If it's 10 metres and assuming the wetland's round, then that's going to be a lot more, yes?
Yes, so the fencing costs range, so for 88 metres
yes.
of fencing, range from 439 to $1,130.
Yeah. Wetlands aren't round, are they?
No.
Farmers like to fence in straight lines, don't they?
Yeah.
So, in actual fact, the length of fencing around whatever size wetland would be significantly more than what you've just said, right?
Potentially, yes.
And you have no idea how expensive?
I haven't done those calculations.
you haven't included the cost of replacement or maintenance of fencing?
No, this is just the installation of fencing and also the calculations for the loss production from the pasture.
Yeah, I'll come back to that. It didn't include any cost of weed control in any of the fenced off areas. You're aware that these small wetlands are going to be spread sporadically across paddocks?
I wouldn't be surprised, yes.
And it's almost certain that the areas around the wetlands are going to overlap?
That seems reasonable.
Which means there'll be even more area fenced off? If you have two intersecting wetlands, you're likely to end up with a greater area than the two individuals.
The amount of fencing may not be greater.
The amount of loss
doing that.
Yeah.
Fencing in between them.
Yeah, but and then just coming back to the basic point, farmers need usable, practical paddocks, don't they?
Yes.
And they're not going to end up with a paddock that's got 10 wetlands fenced off that the sheep have to run around with cattle and maize to try and find grass, are they?
Presumably not.
And again, this is going to be different on every single farm, on every single bit of property.
That's right.
But the only thing we can be certain of is it's going to be significant cost and significant practical implications for the farmer, isn't it?
Yes.
The farmer may also, and I think you made this point fairly, may also need to reorganise existing fences in order to get practical paddocks.
Yes.
May need to relocate water troughs.
Yes.
Water lines. All of that's additional cost you than included.
That's right.
You're likely to get wetlands on arable land as well, aren't you?
Presumably, yeah.
You haven't included the opportunity cost of arable land, have you?
No, I've only done dairy and dry stock.
The witness yesterday said that there were tens of thousands of these wetlands. Your calculation used 10,000 singular, correct?
That's right.
So, in fact, the actual cost could be tens of times more than the 10 or 12 million you said.
Well, I have no basis to determine how much, so I thought I'll pick 10,000 as an indicative sort of number.
But based on everything we've just been through, the figure you gave of 12 million or so is the absolute theoretical best case, i.e. cheapest, isn't it?
That seems likely, yes.
Thank you, no further questions.
Ms. Carruthers for Wairarapi Pastoral.
Thank you, sir. I've got no questions for this witness. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Omni?
Just one question.
Thank you.
You've been asked about the absolute theoretical costs for fencing wetlands. And we have to take into account some unders and overs issues that have been discussed by previous council. Many wetlands will be coincident with the river and stream network, won't they?
Likely, yes.
And so for those wetlands, you wouldn't fence the stream, stop at the wetland and then start the fence again so that you had a circumference right around the wetland, you'd just continue the fencing around the wetland, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Longley. Horticulture New Zealand, Mr. Paul.
Oh, yes. Mr. Keegan, you're not a water quality scientist, are you?
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Ferguson?
No questions.
Mr. Majuri? Mr. Pennell, are you on the line?
Yes, just one question, please, regarding fencing costs. It appears to me that you have used a per metre rate that reflects long fences. Short fences, the cost of strainers and cone assemblies, they are very expensive components and dominate in a short fence. More practically, a short fence cannot hold wire tension. So wires go slack and then they are not spot proof. So normal practice in a short fence is to use post and rails at a much higher cost. I just want to confirm that you won't, that you haven't considered that factor.
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pennell. There's no other person seeking to ask questions. No.
No, thank you, sir.
Yes, please. Thank you, Your Honour. Yes. It's more by way of an observation. First of all, thank you very much for picking up on the concern that was raised. But with respect, I think that information is grossly misleading, simply because you have chosen the least cost option. And just in terms of wetlands, if you look at a 10-metre separation distance, which is what the plan is proposing, what the WRC is proposing, not 3 metres, that doubles the cost of the fence and probably close to 4 times the cost of the land. If you go to the 20 metres, which one party is asking for, it triples the cost of the fencing and increases the cost of the land by 10 times. One of the serious difficulties I'm having is uncertainty about on which to base an informed decision. We also have to pick up on the threads left us by different expert groups. The economists look at it from their point of view, the ecologists look at it from their point of view, and the court has to bring them all together. And we're very, very conscious of the benefits of increased buffer widths. We also have to compare that to the costs. And it's going to be very, very difficult for me to make a decision I'm comfortable with the information we've got available. I think in reality, instead of 12.9 million, we're probably looking well in excess of 100 million, and probably much more than that when you, if there are tens of thousands. In the fencing of streams, the various figures we've seen are $200 million, and it's likely to be less. So I'm wondering how the council can help us get a better handle on the reality of these costs. I have two colleagues sitting next to me, one either side, who are firm believers in the box principle of models, that all models are wrong, some are useful. And so I always like to try and understand what the model is actually telling me. And at the moment, I'm struggling to put that in a real-world situation. So this is perhaps more of an issue for Dr. Olabade, but it is something that I'm concerned about, is the lack of robust information to make a properly informed decision.
Please, could people check their phones?
Sorry, sir.
Thank you. Sorry.
No, it's fine, Your Honour. I just feel that this is such an important issue that isn't well addressed in the evidence, and we're being asked to impose restrictions without any clear idea of what the financial implications of those are. And so that is not a good position for a decision maker to be placed in. So I'm sorry, Your Honour, if I've gone beyond what I should say. That's how I feel. I'm very much a foot-on-the-ground person who likes to understand what a model is telling me and have the information to make my own decision based on that compared to what the reality is on the ground. That's all I have to say. And I do appreciate the fact that you've at least made an attempt at the starting of the process, so thank you for that.
Can I just ask the witness if there's anything that he might like to address in relation to this? Is there anything you'd like to say in evidence in relation to what the Commissioner has raised by his general comment?
I guess one point is that the example that I gave at the beginning of a 50-metre wetland with a 3-metre setback was just one of the choices that I've had a look at, so I've done some sensitivity analysis with some bigger wetlands
as well, and with buffers either 1, 3, 5 or 10 metres. So if you're interested, I have got some other numbers. But I do acknowledge the point that there's a lot of questions remain in terms of the economics. And we've picked up the work that the technical leaders group has done and applied it as best we could.
I honestly appreciate what you've done, because you've put the issue fairly on the table, and I think that's right. My concern was you gave a figure of 12.9 million, and that will be in the minds of a lot of people in this room. I think the reality is that is low by a significant margin. Would you agree with that?
Yes, on the basis that that was for 10,000, and the number we heard earlier was tens of thousands, and also because that is for a 50-metre wetland, 50-square-metre wetland, when that's obviously not the only size of the wetland that we've got, so that it was trying to give an indication of what those small ones look like.
And I appreciate that, but you also chose the 3-metre buffer zone, whereas the plan, as we've got in front of us now, is 10 metres. If it had been 10 metres, and that would have been helpful.
I can give you the equivalent of 10 metres if you like.
Well, I don't want it done on the hoof. I'd like, to be quite honest, what would help me would be a proper exercise that looked at 10,000 small wetlands, 10,500 square metre wetlands, which I think was the figure given yesterday, and the best estimates of lengths of streams for different types of streams and different rates of fencing. But that is what I would need to make a properly informed decision. And then we'd have something to go on. At the moment, it's just back of a cigarette packet, 2 pi r and pi r squared to see what an area is. And that's not a good way to make decisions.
Understand.
But I do thank you very much for putting it on the table. Thank you.
Mr. Keenan, the technical leaders group that was involved, that you were part of in considering this, how wide-ranging was the membership of that group?
So I wasn't a member of that.
Oh, I see.
The economist involved in that was Dr. Graham Dool,
yes,
from the University of Waikato at the time. I believe there were 7 or 8 members of that group. Dr. Dool was the only economist.
I see. In any of your investigation or work or your discussions with your peers in relation to Plan Change 1, have you considered the regulatory impact statements for the stock exclusion regulations?
No.
You're aware of the production of regulatory impact statements?
Yes.
Now, I've had a look at these, and it's a little bit difficult. They've been defaced, unfortunately, with proactively released all over them. And as so often happens with documents produced within ministries, it's very difficult to identify authorship of them. You didn't think that perhaps it might be useful seeing what central government thought about its approach to the question of exclusion and the differing issues of slope, angle, distance, cost of implementation.
If we were doing ongoing work on that, then yes, those would be useful.
Thank you. Anything arising?
Just a few things from me. First of all, Mr. Keenan, I'll get you to turn to the post-conferencing version at page 40 of the provisions. And look at clause 2 in particular. And I just want you to tell us in terms of that clause why you used 3 metres rather than 10?
For the estimates of?
Of the setbacks for, from wetlands, the smaller wetlands.
Well, as I said, I did do 10 as well. I chose a bad example this morning. And the reason why I did varying different setbacks was I did this on Tuesday night and didn't refer to Schedule C.
I'll put this in another way, perhaps. Which wetlands does the 10 metre setback apply to? In two, clause 2A?
Is any wetlands listed in table 3.7.7?
Correct, in table. So that's not all wetlands, is it?
No, I presume not.
And in clause 2C, the 3 metre setback applies to other water bodies, so that would include wetlands not listed in table 3.7.7.
I understand that.
And just in terms of some of those other questions from Commissioner Hodges, you mentioned, and you had accepted to, when questioned by Mr. Matheson and Commissioner Hodges, that your estimate is very much at the lower end, and you mentioned you've done other calculations. Are you able to provide us, and this is something we will have to provide more information on, but what is the upper end of the estimate compared to the 12.9 million?
So for a 50 metre square wetland, the upper end is 57 million. That's a 10 metre buffer. For larger wetlands, it's larger again. So for example, for a 300 metre wetland, it's 93. For a 1200 metre wetland, it's 150 million.
Thank you. And just to report, that is something that we'll look to provide some more comprehensive and detailed information on it. So hopefully assist you a bit further with that.
Mr. Keenan, I'd like to apologise for saying the information was grossly misleading. In the context of that, the 3 metres for the wetlands is fine, but we are being asked by some to make it 10 metres and by others to make it 20 metres. And so we need to have a rational basis for decision making. So all of those options could be considered.
Thank you very much for your evidence, Mr. Keenan. You're excused. Next witness, Mr. Fisher, Mr. Conrad.
Yes, the seventh witness for the council is Dr. Olivoli, who is another economist.
You think?
Just before I get started with this one, so I do have some corrections that he needs to make, which weren't included in the list that we've previously provided, so I'll
clean
those up. Is your full name Ola Cunley, Ola Femi, Ola Bodhi, Ola Sola? Did you prepare evidence in chief dated 26 May 2023 and rebuttal evidence dated 25 August 2023? Yes. Do you have the qualifications and experience here in paragraphs 1 through 5 of your evidence in chief? Yes. Do you have any corrections to make to your evidence in chief?
Yes.
Sorry, to your evidence?
Yes.
And are those the corrections set out in the document which has been handed to up to the court? That's correct.
That's just in paragraph 39 of the evidence in chief and the page in the rebuttal. Is that right?
That's right.
Thank you.
With those corrections, do you confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge?
Yes.
Did you attend expert conferencing on 5th September and sign the joint with the statement? That's fine. Thank you. Please stay seated and ask a few questions.
Thank you.
No questions, Your Honour. Thank you.
River Authority, Ms. Pudo?
No questions, thank you, sir.
Thank you. Fonterra, Mr. Minahan.
Thank you. Good morning, Dr. Olivore. Just got a few questions for you, and just trying to make sure that I understand some of the aspects covered in your evidence. I wish to take you to your rebuttal statement at paragraph 14. So this paragraph, when I read it seemed to be your explanation of the potential benefits or insights to be gained from the modelling exercise. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so you talk in the first sentence there about the how sensitive the achievement of the targets in Plan Change 1 are to mitigation measures such as fencing and riparian margins, but then you also say that the main value is indicating how sensitive achievement of the targets are to typical farm types doing their bit and moving up the general abatement curve. Now, as far as those abatement curves, are those essentially the sum total of all the little things that farmers can do on farm through matters set out in their farm environment plans, as well as compliance with the minimum farm standards? Do I have that right?
Yes.
Thank you. So in terms of stock exclusion, if you just go down a couple of paragraphs to paragraph 17, I just want to be clear on the 16 and 17, you're talking about various mitigation options, and then at 17 you discuss the difference between parameters and variables in the model. Now, are you just able to explain that a little bit more as far as how the difference between those and how, from a modelling perspective, those work?
Yes. In modelling, there are three main components. You have the objectives of what you are trying to do, and then you have variables. The variables are things like you can call levers, what could get you to achieve what you want to achieve, and then you have constraints, things that you don't have control over. So within the variables, it could be, some of them could be parameters for certain context, maybe over a certain time, or over a certain instances,
And so when there are parameters in there, you don't tend to change them often. It means that they are kind of given. But some could be very boosted, you could vary depending on what you're trying to achieve.
Right. So, and then in terms of the approach to stock exclusion, am I right in understanding that the efficacy of stock exclusion was treated as a parameter in the model?
That's correct.
And so that was based on the technical leaders group work as far as what the efficacy of those different measures were?
That's correct.
Yes. And so those percentages that are used as far as efficacy from a modelling perspective suggest that stock exclusion is an effective mitigant.
Yes.
Now, as far as the modelling exercise or the updating of the modelling that you undertook, that was to move from the technical leaders group base version through to the decisions version of PC1.
Yeah.
And so in terms of stock exclusion, that took into account the threshold for stock exclusion using a 15 degree slope.
The slope itself is not specified in the model as a parameter, and so it's the efficacy that have been put in there as a parameter. So I wouldn't know exactly what slope has been considered, but I just know that the efficacy has been put there as parameters.
Okay. If I could take you to paragraph 39 of your rebuttal statement. So this was looking at the, well, there's some consideration of economic viability from a farm perspective. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And just to be clear, as far as the decisions version model that you undertook, that suggested that the approach to stock exclusion resulted in a situation where water quality targets could be met without making farms uneconomical. Is that my reading of it?
Yes.
Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you. Land Corp will lock you not present. No. Thank you, Mr. Mathis.
Thank you. Good morning. Just an answer to... just an answer to a question by my friend for Fonterra. You said that slope was not specified in the model.
Correct. Well, I mean, as a parameter.
Yeah, as a parameter.
But
yeah.
It has been considered in the efficacies and in the other parameters.
Are you aware of the relative percent of dry stock farm in the catchment that's up to 10 degrees, between 10 and 15 degrees, and above 15 degrees? Was that proportion of land in each category considered?
Yes, actually. So in terms of the typical farms that were considered in the model, yeah.
So my understanding is 69.2% of the dry stock farms are on land up to 10 degrees. 13.5% are in the 10 to 15 degrees, and 17% is above 10 degrees. Does that sound about right, based on your work?
I'm not exactly sure about the figures you quoted,
yeah.
But I have idea that indication has been captured in the model in terms of having a typical traditional hill country farms, having larger proportion of the land in the dry soil sector.
Thank you.
That's the question.
Mr. Others for Wairaki Pastoral.
No questions for me. Thank you, Your Honour.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to clarify one issue, and I think you've seen this in your evidence, but the modelling was done on the nitrogen leaching loss right in the decisions version of the plan and not on the Fonterra risk scorecard approach. Is that right? Thank you.
So that was correct, was it, Duncan?
Yes, correct.
Thank you. Horticulture New Zealand.
No, thanks.
Mr. Ferguson?
Just a couple of questions, yes, thank you.
Just as yesterday I was cautionary in embarking on the field of mathematics, I think I'll be doubly so in the field of economics and modelling, so please bear with me if I am unclear in a couple of matters that I want to clarify with you. One matter related to your rebuttal evidence, and you presumably have a copy of that with you, and I wanted to take you first to paragraph 13 on page 301.0401. And you state there the modelling approach was that no pastoral and commercial vegetable production farms would stay at their baseline level of diffuse discharge of contaminants. Rather, it was assumed that each would move up their respective abatement curves to reduce their diffuse discharge of contaminants at a cost, and I refer to the abatement curves as otherwise known as profit contaminant trade-off curves. And then further on, in relation to the same matter, paragraph 28 on page 301.0406, they, as explained above, the land of land application model, I think it is. Mitigations are in two stages. The first are along the abatement curve, figure one above for each farm type. This assumes that farms are not going to remain at their baseline level of produced discharge and that novel options have a negative impact on farm profitability. And so, just to clarify, I mean, it seems evident, you're saying that the modelling assumption is that all farms will move up this abatement curve as a matter of choice by farm operators, is that correct?
Some farms, because the model itself is an optimization model, so the model we use that feature to decide which farms we move up. So I just gave indication to the model to say, do not let some farms stay in their baseline level, particularly dairy and horticulture. Dry stock.
Right.
So, and then I indicate to what extent they can move. So, that is also somewhere there in my evidence.
So you've just said an answer to my question that you've assumed some farms will move, but in paragraph 30 you said the modelling approach was that no farms will stay and that each would move. So, which is it? Did you make the assumption that all farms would move up the abatement curve, or that some farms, and if it's some farms, what was the methodology and the assumption that that was based on?
Okay. Yeah, it was some farm, as I've mentioned, because of the profitability and the nutrient loss profile for these farm types, for these sectors, so I have assumed that would be dairy, dry stock and horticulture. So there has no need for forestry to do.
So what does some farms mean?
So, I mean, the farm types within dairy, and then those within dry stock sectors and those within the horticulture.
But do you assume that 75% would move up the abatement curve in each sector, or when you say some, it's either I'm trying to get to the precision of the calculation you carried out.
So it's no calculation there. It's based on the information we have in the model. So for dry for dairy farm, we have about 24 farm types in dairy, and for each of them we have a range of mitigation options they can take, and that can be between 1 and up to 18. And then for dry stock we have five farm types represented in the model, and each of them have five levels of mitigation they can take. And then for horticulture we have three farm types there, and each of them has about seven mitigation options. So what I told the model was to say, let dairy farm types be able to move, or none of the dairy farms should stay at the baseline level. So they should move between step two up to step seven. So the optimization feature of the model decide where they move to for me.
So the assumption there is they're all going to move?
Yes, for dairy.
For dairy, but you'd expect, and particularly when we're looking at the rules and when we're looking at the low-risk permitted activities, that there's no obligation for a number of farming activities to move at all along an abatement curve.
Yes, I think I indicated that as well, that it's the extent to which they have to move, it's not known, so it's just more about assumptions. So imagine that there's going to be de-intensification in order to achieve the target. So what the model was trying to do, what I was using the model to do, was to say to what extent can mitigation achieve the target that has been set in the decision version. So I have to decide that either there's going to be land use change, or that the farm types will have to move up on their abatement cost curve. So if this is an assumption that's relying on what the provision is trying to achieve. So the provision, my understanding is that it's trying to make sure that the farms will have to make adjustment to their management and have to do some abatement.
And you were here yesterday when I think Mr. Broxoff was giving evidence, that's correct?
Yeah.
And I think you might have heard that he referred to the possibility of some intensity creep. So if we've got, for example, a rule that allows for a stock intensity of up to 17 stock units, but at 2016 a particular farm is only operating at 10 stock units, even at that low risk level, there's a potential for that farm to increase stock units to 17. Therefore, you've got an increase in intensity, and you've got a move, potentially a movement down the abatement curve, not up it. In the case of that farm, you'd accept that's a possibility.
Yes, that's a possibility, and it's also part of what we have in the model. Because if we have the farm types and we recognize what they are currently doing, and we match the mitigation options that look appropriate for that kind of farm types in terms of what they are doing and what they might need to do. It may not necessarily mean reducing stocking rates. Some would just might be they have to bring in infrastructure like capital, and some might just need to retire some area of farms and still retain existing stocking rates in the other parts.
And I think listening to this, and you've been clear, I think, that the magnitudes that the modelling produces are indications only. There's no guaranteed precision in any of that. That's accepted, isn't it? As you sat here, and I've seen you in the back of the court listening for the last few days, what's going to be critical about turning these types of models into proper assessment tools on the ground it's imperative, isn't it, that we actually have actual data of what is occurring on each farm and across each sub-catchment and across the catchment as a whole in order to be able to truly assess the impact and the degree to which we are achieving the outcomes that PC1 is designed to achieve, correct?
That's right, that's the ideal.
And I know that we've got a little bit of difference of opinion between Ms. Robson for CNI and yourself around whether the scenarios model for Tangata Whenua or ancestral land are worst case scenario or not. And I don't propose to go into that, but it's correct, isn't it, that again, with that modelling, a range of assumptions are made, but whether it's a 0.7% increase in footprint, if we call it footprint, a 0.2%, a 0.9%, which are some of the figures that were within the scenarios that were run, in order to be able to again assess those potential impacts and the capacity for the river to accommodate that, we again need to be able to know what headroom has been created over the life of this plan, don't we? Accept that. Thank you, I'll make it.
Mr. Pennell, are you there?
Yes, I have no questions, thank you.
Thank you. Re-examination?
No, thank you, sir.
Questions?
morning, Doctor. Perhaps just to pick up on some of the questions that Mr. Ferguson has just finished with you on. You've talked at that paragraph 55 of your rebuttal evidence about the matters that Ms. Robson and you have, I suppose, some engagement about. I just want to be clear, because I don't know the answer, which I'm looking for some guidance from you. Are these, on the three scenarios which you've indicated here, for example, in terms of loads, if I'm looking at what is considered to be an adverse effect on the environment, which will be minor, is 0.7% a minor adverse effect in terms of nitrogen, for example?
I don't know.
You don't know?
No.
You can't give me any guidance around those issues?
No. Because they tend to be water quality domains, which is normally my area. So what I'm putting out there is just that. The directions and how sensitive those concentrations are to mitigation options and to what we might do for not necessarily the numbers.
Okay, right, thank you.
Anything else? Thank you. Commissioners? Commissioner Layton? Commissioner Hodges?
Thank you. Thank you, Alan. Good morning, Dr. Alabody. First of all, I'd just like to make sure I have a correct understanding of this, and that's that your modelling is based on the CLUES model, which is a well-recognised model in New Zealand, and presumably no one has challenged that that's not the right thing to do. Is that correct?
Yeah, those hybrid, those studies and science have been peer reviewed.
Okay. I thought that was the case, but I thought it was the case.
Yes.
And did you, with your baseline case, did you do any checks of the model predictions against actual measured values in particular water bodies?
If you're talking about the hydrological models, that wasn't my area, that was what I did. So my model is, the model we're using is an economic model that has the hydrological model plugged in.
Right.
Yeah, so I wasn't doing the hydrological modeling.
Okay, thank you, that's fine. Do you think if there was a change from the overseer method of calculating nitrogen losses to the Fonterra risk scorecard, that would be a problem, or is that outside your area of expertise?
It's outside my area.
Okay. And can you please turn to paragraph 23 in your evidence in chief? significant changes that are likely to be required in high nitrogen leaching farms. And it talks about significant, effectively, changes to land use that might be required. Did your modelling indicate by when those changes would be required?
No. So the timing was kind of not explicit.
Right. Okay, no, that sounds fine. Thank you. And in your abstract to your 2022 report, which you attached as an appendix, if you go to that as well, please. It's in the fourth paragraph. You say, this together with further mitigation options are reflected in the sector's profits and production. Overall, there is a potential loss of about 18% of catchment level income in the long-term scenario and about 16% in the short-term scenario. See that there?
Yes.
Does that mean that the majority of the mitigations will be in place within 10 years? Is that what that's saying?
That's a reflection of the optimization feature of the model that assumed that to achieve 20%, so we need to do this much, and then work out the cost of that. And it might also be in the long term, which is about 18%, so it might, the model, the optimization feature, might have considered that the gap between what's to be achieved in this interim and what to be achieved in a later time. So it means that 20% target excuse me. So what I'm trying to say there was, if you look at table 13 of the same report.
Table what, sorry?
Table 13, 1-3.
Page 30 or page 0354.
Yes, okay. Thank you. Yeah.
So the short time in the column, so the column 4, we are reporting short time figures. So that's where the 16% reduction in income comes from.
Yes.
And in that, we have there is not much difference between what dairies have to do in the short and the long term, and there is a bit of difference between dry stock and then in the horticulture. There's much to do in the long term compared to the short term. So what is happening in there is the optimization feature of the model is placing priority on what needs to be done in the interim.
Okay, but my question really was saying that it requires an awful lot to be done in the short term and not much more in the long term. Is that right?
Yes, because we have the target for the long term and we have the target for the short term.
But it's upfront cost loaded, basically.
Yes.
Okay, that's what I was trying to say.
That's, I think, that's the 20% target for the current period, the current 10 year period.
And in the same extract, you talk about the results suggest the impact is specific to nitrogen. What effects? Nitrogen appears to be the contaminant with the least requirement for a percentage reduction, and sediment loss is much greater. sediment reduction will be much greater. That didn't show up in your model, that sediment's going to be a controlling issue at all?
I think it'd be about 20%, because in I have a table that summarizes the percentage reduction required. That's in demo one.
In which document?
The same report.
So that's page 2.
I'm just trying to understand why nitrogen, with the least overall reduction required, is the driving force when all of the other parameters need a much greater reduction.
I guess this is an example of parameters in the model, so the model that are given in the provisions, as in the table 3.11.1, so it's just because what is given.
Can you please turn to table 1 on page 15 of your evidence sheet? Issue too hard. You've got an item there for string fencing and riparian of 4.03 million, I understand that.
Yes.
What does that include? How is it made up is what I'm really trying to understand.
That's made up of cost of fencing and the cost of loss to area taken away from production.
And over what period is that? That's over the 10-year period?
The short term, yes, about the short term, 10-year period, yeah.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the only cost of fencing is 4.03 million, and that would include any removal, any replacement of existing fences, relocation, maintenance, or it's intended to include all of those things, is that correct?
No, it just includes the cost of putting on fencing. And then the
okay.
Cost.
Now then, if you move further down the table, and you've got a section there on reduced extent of specific mitigations, and when you go down to the water quality attribute targets, even if you reduce the mitigations by 100%, I don't know what that means, does it mean you do nothing?
You do nothing.
Okay, well, it doesn't seem to affect anything apart from E. coli.
Yeah.
So, just doing all the mitigations and doing nothing doesn't alter the number of exceedances,
yes,
or
so
not exceedances.
Yeah. The mitigations I'm referring to here are the additional mitigations that kind of includes what I put and tip and so this is not about this is. Mitigations that are not within the abatement cost movement. So the abatement cost movement is still part of what we have here. So I couldn't do sensitivity analysis around that because it was short notice. So I did the sensitivity analysis following the mediation where it was asked what would it mean if I could do any sensitivity analysis to the extent of those specific mitigations. So those were just edge of peat mitigations, no substitution.
Sorry, I missed that first.
Okay. So what I'm saying is, as I've explained in the modeling, that the mitigations are divided into two parts. We have the movements of pan fires along the abatement cost curve, And then on top of that, I play around to what extent can we add on things like do the fencing, do the riparian margin, or do the edge of field mitigations. So the stage, the second stage of mitigations were what I was testing here.
And that did you say that included extra riparian planting and extra fencing?
Yes.
Extra over and above the figure of 4 million you had before, is that correct?
So the 4 million was what this was about. The in that table where I talked about.
It's those mitigation measures you're talking about.
Yes. So in table 13, we are talking about mitigation costs. So those are the kind of specific mitigation and doing sensitivity analysis in that table 1 there. So it does not include the stage 1 mitigations where the farm types have to move on their abatement cost for to mitigate the leaching. So it's quite a small part of the mitigations in essence, that's what that means.
Okay, well, when you refer to leaching, are you talking about nitrogen or are you talking about all four contaminants?
All four contaminants that were embedded in those type of mitigation options.
Okay, and presumably in the first set of mitigation options there'll be other fencing costs already included, is that correct?
Like repairing marginal lands and dry stock farming, yes.
Okay. All right, well, at least now I understand it, thank you. No, that's fine, thank you. That's all my questions. Thank you, Dr. Oliver.
I have no questions, thank you, Doctor. Anything arising out of the court's questions? No? Thank you very much for your evidence, your excuse. Good timing again. So we'll take the break now. I think you've got Mr. Kedilko with the next witness.
Yes, that's right, sir.
Very good. All right. We'll return at 4:00.